Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Imagine your favorite novel. Can you picture the protagonist in detail? What about the villain? What about the places where the action happens? Before you reflexively answer, of course, you might consider how much authors don't describe, choosing instead to lavish attention on details that tell something important about character or theme or plot. We have so much practice filling in or overlooking what's left out of our fiction that it's easy not to even realize what's missing. But as my guest today will remind us, it can be highly illuminating to consider the ways that written words and our own imaginations combine to create stories that come alive in our brains. Peter Mendelsohn is Associate Art Director at Alfred A. Knopf Books. He's created covers for dozens of books, including the one he has just written and illustrated for himself called What We See When We Read. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
I love this book because it caused me to think about something I had taken for granted, which is that I can see stories as I read them, and then to question whether I've ever really seen anything at all. How did those questions start to occur to you?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a art director and designer, and I've been doing that job for almost 12 years now, and ostensibly my job is to read these books, see the things that the author is putting forward, and then translate those into book jackets. And at one point, I just sort of examined the process in a little more detail. I'd been doing it, like I said, for many, many years, and just some surprising things started to pop out at me. And around that time, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who's also a writer, and he told me this story. He grew up in suburban Albany, New York, and he told me this story that all of the sort of classical literature that he read up until the time that he was in college, he used to situate in the local, mentally situate the all of these incredible stories from far-flung places, exotic places. He would always situate them in the backyards and school gymnasiums of his local suburb. And I just thought that was hilarious at first, this idea of, you know, like the some of the incredible ballroom scenes in Tolstoy taking place in a gymnasium in Albany just seemed so bizarre to me. And then, of course, it just occurred to me, oh, of course, I do this too. Yeah. And everybody does. And then it occurred to me, of course, the sort of part of the, you know, one of the important constituent parts of the imagination is memory. And that just spurred a whole investigation and sort of unpacking of the process for me, which, you know, I had thought for years was a very straightforward thing, but turns out not to be.
You make this provocative statement that memory of reading is a false memory. What do you mean by that?
It's not, maybe I should amend that. It's really not so much that it's false, but it's as much a fiction as the fictions that we're reading themselves. You know, the metaphor that we like to use is, you know, we imagine that reading is sort of like watching a film, and that we're very passive in that regard, and we sit back in our chairs and we see the author's world sort of projected into our minds. And and that really isn't, as soon as you sort of turn the lens inward, as it were, and start to kind of parse that process a little bit, the less it seems like a film and more like something very bizarre indeed that's truly co-creative.
So your primary example here is Anna Karenina. We are sure that Tolstoy has told us everything about her, only to discover that a lot is left not elaborated upon.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, when I was compiling this book, at one point I went through my translation of Anna Karenina and I pulled out every single character description of Anna in the book, and it made for two double-spaced pages, mostly repetitions about how small her hands are and how sort of, I guess, full-figured, chubby, I suppose, and her black hair. And that's, you know, that's really what you have. I mean, he remarks that she has a tiny little downy mustache, which was really shocking to me. And somehow I had just completely cut that, I deleted that out of my memory of Anna Karenina entirely. I just waxed that mustache right off in my mind. But yeah, there's very, very little there. And in fact, most of what we know about Anna, we know about experiencing her interactions with other people. It's more sort of an emergent character than it is sort of something that you see in sort of the optical sense, although we kind of fool ourselves into thinking that that we are seeing her in the optical sense.
But if a writer were to provide all of those specific details, the work would come across as pretty pedantic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be really tedious reading. And, you know, I think that something else I say in the book is that the great writers know when to omit things, much in the way that a great composer will know when to include a rest in a piece of music. And that those rests, those omissions really encourage us as readers to sort of to fill in those gaps. And filling in those gaps, I would posit, is one of the things that we enjoy doing the most when we read, although we may not be aware that we're doing it. It's one of the reasons why at least I keep being drawn back to fiction. If someone were to, you know, I don't feel overly compelled to see the film version of Anna Karenina over and over because of the sort of thusness of it. You're shown everything. There it is. But when you read, again, it's just so much a richer experience for your inclusion in it.
What a responsibility, though, for someone who does create a film version of a novel, right? The director and the art director and the director of cinematography and the people who do the sets and the costumes, they have to visualize this thing entirely, even if they wouldn't do so naturally, and then sort of foist their vision off on everybody who ever sees the film.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very much like being a book jacket designer in that sense. You're, you know, and fiction in general is so great at interiority, at inside looking out. That's what it does better than anything. And film, of course, is sort of great at the opposite. It's really great at sort of this objectivist version of the world. And it's not particularly good at interiority. So there's always this weird feeling when you see these interior worlds turned outward in the way in which film does them, or in the way in which book jackets do them. You know, just the character ceases to be, when shown, significant in a certain way. They just become a thing, like a flower pot, or it's a very interesting transformation and always really disappointing.
I was thinking about the differences between fiction and nonfiction. I read a lot of nonfiction for this show, and I actually really like the form. But it's very, very rare for, say, a work of history to, as everybody claims, read like a novel. And I was thinking that maybe that's because when you know a fact and you're a historian, you want to get that fact in there. And when you're a novelist, you maybe are much more selective about what you include.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, there's history and there's history. There's all kinds of history books, and some history books are laden with facts and others are more narrative driven. I think great historians do actually provide the same sort of narrative sweep that a great novel will. I mean, interestingly, I found, and this happened pretty late into the process of writing this book, I started to examine some of my responses to nonfiction. I found I was doing exactly the same thing. At the time, I'd been reading this book on Stalingrad by Antony Beevor, which is an amazing book. And I realized at one point that that the Soviet counterassault that I was reading about was taking place somewhere in New Jersey over the Hudson River out my window. I was like, wait a second. And what was interesting about that is that, you know, when you do that, even if you are aware of doing that kind of transposition when you're reading fiction, there's no ethical dilemma there. You don't feel that there's anything wrong with personalizing, but it does feel actually somewhat wrong to do that when you're reading nonfiction. You feel very much the onus of having to imagine, in order to honor the victim, say, or just to cleave as close to reality as possible, to get really a picture that has some degree of verisimilitude. So it's this very strange thing, and yet I don't feel that we're able to control that impulse, even with reading nonfiction.
But I suppose that maybe we're straining against the sense of responsibility when we're reading nonfiction, that we ought to be doing.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. That's right.
It occurred to me over and over reading this book how similar the process of visualizing a book is to the way we dream, right? Because you can in a dream sort of know what surrounds you, but not really be seeing those details. You're focused on the imagery that, for whatever reason, your brain has cooked up for you in a particular dream.
That's right. And I'm really glad you mentioned that. You're the first person to talk to me about that. In fact, the big revelation for me was, in fact, that our imaginations can sort of be psychoanalyzed in the same way that dreams sort of classically are. And that really came as a shock to me that, you know, if I was looking back on what my imagination had done while reading a particular piece of fiction, and I sort of took apart the components of that particular piece of imagining, there was lots of interesting stuff there. Well, why was I picturing that particular person that I had had a fight with last week? Oh, because I had a fight with them last week. That's why they became the antagonist in this particular novel. Or, you know, it's very similar to the way you try to decipher your dreams. And yeah, there are many similarities. Mostly, I mean, the biggest one just structurally is that, you know, we make our dreams out of our memories, and we do the same with our imagination.
Why do you find it easier to hear what you are reading?
I'm not exactly sure why, and yet whenever there's – it might have something to do that when there's, important sound in a novel that novelists try very hard to use. You know, there's an onomatopoeia that sort of takes place. I was recently talking to somebody about the opening of Gravity's Rainbow, which is a screaming comes across the sky, which is describing a bomb falling on London during the war. And I realized that the word screaming was exactly the right word to describe a V-rocket sound. And authors, I think, are very attuned to the fact that words are, you know, when uttered, make sounds. And I do think that we actually hear on some level not just what the words are signifying, but the words themselves as we're reading them. I mean, and this is something Proust actually mentioned also, that there's a part of us that we background that's listening to the words as we're reading them, much in the way that there's a part of us that we also background mentally that's seeing the letter forms of the words as we read them. And a lot of the reading experience is sort of put together from all of that backgrounding and foregrounding. It's a very interesting process.
We could go far down the rabbit hole here, but another interesting thing to consider is when you mention a bomb screaming across the sky, I was able to sort of visualize that or hear that as you mentioned it. I've never had that experience, and in fact, the only reason that it sounds right to me is because I've experienced that in movies.
Yeah, it's not like I was in London during the war. I don't have a lot of experience with V-bombs falling. And yet, you know, I remember when I was reading Gravity's Rainbow, you know, looking for footage. And there's plenty of it. And you can hear that sound. And he could have used any other word, but a screaming, it's exactly the right sound.
So when an author does choose to give you a visual detail, it almost always means something more than simply letting you know the shape of the form of something.
Yeah, that's right. And an example I use in the book is Anna Karenina's husband, an older fella who she's sort of falling out of love with as she falls in love with the young Vronsky. She meets him at the train station, and his ears are described, and they're described as sort of, depending on the translation, but they're described as sort of protruding. And, you know, I've always wondered, well, what is that? He had big ears, right? But, you know, I've read this book several times since I was a teen, and the more I read it and the older I get, I realize that actually his ears might be perfectly normal. It's just that, you know, she's kind of noticing, she's looking for flaws. Mm-hmm. So his ears are less sort of, again, optically a structural part of him and more an important structural part of the narrative.
My guest is Peter Mendelsohn. He's Associate Art Director of Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of the new book, What We See When We Read. We'd love for you to join us in this conversation. You can do so by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Peter Mendelsohn. He is Associate Art Director of Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of the new book, What We See When We Read. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from CP who says, please contrast what we see when we read with what we do when we see a movie made from a book and how those two forms differ when we read the book before or after we have seen the movie.
I can only speak to my own experience, mm-hmm. but I've never been able to get a film adaptation out of my mind in subsequent readings of a book. You know, Harry Potter is always going to be, you know, the Harry Potter from the movie. It's very hard when you've seen something, again, in the optical sense, it's very hard then to remove that vision from your mind, which is why I see adaptations. I try to avoid them if possible, especially for any book that I really loved.
So when you're illustrating a novel, the cover of a novel, what are you careful to avoid putting in people's heads?
I just try to use as little as possible from the book while still somehow indicating something of the world of the book, which is a really difficult balancing act to pull off. Mostly I try to sort of use abstraction where possible. I worked on the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo cover, and that was an example of a jacket where it would have been really easy to use a snowy Swedish island or somebody covered with blood or a murder weapon. Or there were lots of sort of things that you could show from that book that I think, to do the cliche thing, those are the things that I would have employed. But I tried really hard not to sort of give too much away. The key there is really just... actually, the truth is, in my heart of hearts, when I'm making a book jacket, the most important thing of all is just to make something pretty. It doesn't really matter that much sort of what you show or what you don't show. If you just make it pretty enough, you're really just trying to draw people closer to the text. I just feel like, sort of the cardinal sins are showing a character full on. That's really the big one you want to avoid. And as a result, I think most book cover designers spend a lot of their day sort of shifting characters' faces around so that they can be blocked by something else or cut off in the right way. Or, you want to see a character maybe like they're just rounding a corner. Like you just get a brief glimpse and you can't quite resolve it into a full human being, which is actually, honestly, now that I'm saying it, is a lot the way reading about a character feels. It's not, you're looking for the outlines, not the detail. So that's true about cover design as well. So wherever I can avoid showing too much, I do. And I do feel also that if all book jackets could just be all type, I think that would be a great thing.
I remember as a kid reading and rereading the Little House on the Prairie series, which at the time had illustrations by Garth Williams, I think it was. And I liked the pictures, but I remember thinking, well, that's not what they look like. Like, I would enjoy looking at them, but then I was quite certain that he was incorrect with his interpretation of what the family looked like.
I mean, that's wonderful that you knew that there was that, that you were aware of that sort of cognitive dissonance when you were young. I mean, I think a lot of my kids, when they read something, they're very, very heavily influenced by whatever visual prompts they're given. I don't mean narrative visual prompts, but like you said, illustrations or covers. I would think, and I guess I would ask you this question, when the TV series came on, did that just obliterate those? Were you picturing those characters from the TV show?
They were almost like it was almost a different thing because they didn't have any of the stories really, as you may know, because you're not a woman. But the TV series was really just kind of loosely based on the novels themselves, which I gather were loosely based on the reality. And so you have multiple kind of layers of abstraction there. But no, I didn't picture the TV series characters at all when I read the books.
I would imagine that if I were to read the books now, it would be very hard to get those television characters out of my own mind. I mean, like I said, I really try to avoid all visual prompts. Yeah, and I find illustrated novels, of which there were quite a bit, especially in the 19th century, and there were even some illustrator authors. Thackeray comes to mind, and Dickens was very involved in the illustrations of his books. I always find that so strange. You know, Henry James made a comment that anything that relieves a text of the responsibility of being good enough on its own is something that should be avoided. And I kind of agree with that. What makes text magical is that it does put you in this sort of metaphysical other realm that you get to sort of cohabitate with the author and other readers, and making something concrete just takes you right out of that magical, cloudy, mystical place where I would love to spend most of my time.
I was delighted after reading your book to start thinking about this, the fact that stories cause us regularly to start off with a certain set of pictures and assumptions in our head and then radically change them 3 pages later when more information becomes available.
Yeah, that's another sort of strange thing that we do as readers, that when we tell the story of reading, or when we think of the story of reading, we manage to omit that part entirely, that we're making adjustments all the time. And it's not just that when you're reading, you're sort of trying to imagine what's going to happen down the line. Well, you spend a lot of time when you're reading thinking about things that you're not actually reading, but things that you think you will be reading, especially in certain genres like mystery and crime thrillers, where you're, you know, there's whole genres that are sort of predicated on that you're going to be constantly working to try to be puzzle solving. And you're remembering things that you've read several pages earlier, but that, you know, new information is arising all the time about characters that you may have been thinking that you've been picturing in one particular way. And then lo and behold, they're a blonde on page 75. And you have to completely, you know, new wig for that character. And that's why in the book I sort of discuss characters as roles in the sort of theatrical sense. And I wonder a little bit why we don't use a similar terminology as we do in the theater with sets and roles. Those terms imply a kind of enactment in a way that character and setting don't, but they're more honest terms in that they show how these are choices that we make in a way. When we read, we're directing a play of a sort. You know, we're choosing the sets and we're choosing the costumes and we're casting the thing. So, it's a very odd. Reading is just incredibly odd. And for me, having done this my entire life, and like I said, 12 years professionally, it was particularly shocking to discover it this late.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with India in Mansfield. Hi, India.
Hi there, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to comment on what y'all were talking about earlier about that character with the protruding ears, and whether or not, you know, things like that are purposeful on the author's part, and, you know, what kind of significance, if any, they have. I'm an English major at UTA right now, and what a lot of non-English majors, like their beef with reading in English classes is that, you know, there are these little details that they think, oh, those curtains are just blue and that's it. But are those curtains blue to symbolize sadness or maybe tranquility? And so I guess my question is that, is it possible for, you know, little insignificant or significant details to have meaning, or are, you know, is it possible for them to just be out there meaninglessly just to, you know, take up space?
Yeah, well, actually, both are possible. And, you know, in the world of fiction, you have all kinds of writers. And for some of them, the most important thing is that the plot keep moving. And in those cases, sometimes details are just details. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And that is not true for Tolstoy. I mean, you know, he does, like I said, repeat the fact that Anna has small hands. And I almost think he repeats that so so as to reinforce that it's not particularly significant. It's just sort of a fact of her physiognomy. But with her husband's ears, he notes them in such a particular moment, right at the moment of disaffection where she's falling in love with Vronsky and she meets him and it's like she's in love with another man and it's like she's seeing her husband for the first time. And, you know, we've all experienced this in small ways. Forgive me, my wife, if you're listening, but it's like with our spouses, there's something that they do. You know, they might stir their tea and the spoon is hitting the cup and you're like, oh, my God, they always do that. And just the moment at which you realize that is a very pregnant moment. And I'm sure that I do these things, too. But, you know, I think Tolstoy did that very, very conscientiously. He's like, this is the moment at which Karenin's, she notices that his ears are big. They might be slightly big, but I doubt that he's, you know, and you, as you're reading, you might imagine him as Dumbo the elephant. I don't know what you're thinking at that moment. But what I do know is that the fact that it's called out at that moment makes it more important structurally in the narrative than it really is as sort of an optical fact of him. And like I said, so authors tell us things for any number of different reasons. And some of those reasons might be to help us picture. And some of those reasons might be for kind of metaphorical purposes. It really depends on the book and where you are in the book and the skill of the writer involved. But it's very good as a reader. I mean, it's crucial as a reader to be constantly alert to those places where an author is trying to signify something other than just what's happening. That's really also what makes fiction magical and important. It's not just narrative. I think all of those things are possible in fiction.
When you talk about reading ahead, imagining what's to come, it's simply part of the reading process, I suppose, if we're doing it right. Something that also sometimes trips us up, and you mentioned reading to your children, sometimes we start to read a bit of dialogue, and then at the end there are instructions about how that dialogue was supposed to sound. And those are always a little bit jarring if we've gotten it wrong.
Yeah, no, one of the examples I like to think of is I was reading Harry Potter to my youngest daughter, and Harry and someone else are in a hallway, and they hear this scream, you know, ah! And then on the next page, it was Professor Trelawney. So I just sort of go back and go, ah!
And she made you go back and do it right.
No, I made myself go back and do it right. I mean, the interesting thing there is that I only noticed that because I was reading aloud. I mean, the same mental processes take place when you're reading quietly to yourself, but you're just not aware that you're doing it. When you're reading aloud, that performative aspect of those readings really, calls those things into high relief. And it's hilarious for my children. You got to do the voices when you're reading to your children. It's crucial.
Yeah, we always debated actually reading the Harry Potter books out loud about whether I should attempt very poorly to do them in dialect or whether I could just get these, choke these out as an American. And I think it went half and half.
Yeah, I think with me too. And the movies actually made everything much more difficult because there are all these, as you put it, regional dialects. You know, there's some of the professors have sort of Northern English accents,
right.
And, you know, Hagrid's a Scotsman. So, you know, you really have to pull out your accent chops for that one. And the kids would be really disappointed if I didn't do that. So you always got to try your best and probably make a fool out of yourself.
We've had actually a lot of good dinner table conversations since I've read this book. And my daughter mentioned the phenomenon that I realized is common to a lot of people. And I feel it, too. Sometimes it's easier to picture someone we don't know very well at all than the people that we're closest to if we are calling up a memory. And I don't fully understand that, but I feel like that exists for us when we read novels as well.
Yeah. You mean it's easier to picture someone you know well in real life than it is. It's easier to picture a fictional character in some ways than it is to remember someone you know well in real life. Is that what you're saying?
It's actually easier in some ways to picture the face of like a neighbor four doors down that I see, you know, once a month.
Oh, I see.
Than it is to picture, you know, my husband, my mother, my daughter, even though I would know them anywhere, I suppose, because I've seen every possible expression of their faces and I don't know which to pick.
I think that's actually, I think you answered your own question brilliantly. That's right. There's too much information to work from. Whereas, you know, the neighbor four doors down is really more an archetype than he is a you know, he or she is a full-blooded person. You know, they're just, they're the neighbor, and probably, you know, you'd affix a couple adjectives to them at most. But with someone you know well and you love, one of your children, or, you know, someone else in your family, like you said, there's just, you're aware of the full three-dimensionality of the person. And of course, you also know their character. And what's interesting is this, there's this kind of reverse phrenology that we do where when we know someone's character, we then allow that to change the way we think about the way they look. And, you know, when you're really well acquainted with someone, when you're intimate with them, it almost puts a lens between you and them. It definitely alters the way you see them. Their character changes their appearance for you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Aaron in Bedford on the phone now. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you guys? You guys are doing a great show.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Hey, years ago as a kid, I read many books, of course, and in a small town, you read a lot of books. But one book that always stuck with me as a kid, and to this day I'm a horseman, is the story of Smokey the Cowhorse. And I believe it's a Pulitzer Prize winner from Will James back in 1927. Wonderful graphics, so much so that when you read the book, the graphics exceed your imagination. And when you follow the character, it's almost a Western rough version of Black Beauty. But when you see the drawings there, I think they're almost accurate. Actually, when you have an expectation of what you're imagining as a kid, these artistic graphics are just amazing. Are there many books nowadays that are as accurate as that?
Well, you know what, Aaron, we're just about to take a break. So, Peter, keep that in your head, and maybe you can respond to what Aaron has told us about Smokey the Cowhorse in just a minute. My guest is Peter Mendelson, Associate Art Director at Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of the book What We See When We Read. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Peter Mendelson, who is Associate Art Director of Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of the new book, What We See When We Read. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, which is where, Peter, you'll recall, Aaron called us just before the break and talked about the amazing illustrations in Will James's Smokey the Cowhorse that, in his mind, were, I guess, as influential to him as the text itself.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, Aaron is the second person to mention Smokey the Cowhorse to me this week.
Wow.
I was just talking to my grandmother and asking her about the books that she read as a kid, and she was an avid horseback rider, and she was telling me about the exact same book, which I think won the Newbery Medal, if I'm wrong. And I guess all I would say is that, you know, these days there's all kinds of literature that is both, you know, we have straight up prose, and we have illustrated novels, and we have graphic novels. And there are all kinds of sort of media in which words and images cohabitate. And, you know, I can't really address qualitatively what changes, but I will say that, you know, yeah, sometimes the art is supposed to be the star of the show. And, you know, at where I work at Knopf, we also do a tremendous amount of graphic novels, Daniel Clowes and Chris Ware and people like that. And in those cases, they're a real marriage of incredibly gorgeous, beautiful, imagery, and the same can be said of the text, and they sort of...
Okay, it looks like we have lost Peter Mendelssohn, our guest. He is online in a studio right now in New York City. We will work to get him right back on. Peter, you are not with us, correct? Okay, my guest is Associate Art Director of Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of What We See When We Read. I would be very interested to hear from you about your ideas of this as we are getting Peter back on the line. So let's now take this online, and you can also send email to think@kera.org to continue the discussion. Let's hear now from Jody in Dallas. Hey, Jody.
Hi. Talking about Anna's small hands, may that be telling us of her inability to handle, that is, inability to cope with things?
Huh. That's a really interesting... Is that something that you, the first time you read it, did it strike you that that's why it kept coming up in the text?
No, almost nothing really strikes me the first time I read anything. I have to go back, but it's a recent observation.
Yeah, I guess that's also part of the pleasure of reading, right, is going back to things that you have come to love. Yeah. Well, we will talk a bit more about this in just a minute. Thank you so much for your call, Jody.
Sure.
If you would like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Maybe you want to talk about your experiences in seeing a text, maybe what you don't see and what you don't need to see as you read particular stories. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, and we'll come back in just a minute. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We have back on the line now Peter Mendelssohn talking about his book, What We See When We Read. Peter, sorry about that little glitch. I wonder if there's a possibility that, you know, people are always trying to figure out where lies the division between people who love to read and people who read well but simply don't enjoy it. And I wonder if there's something about that lack of visual information or the things that we have to fill in for ourselves or be happy with not knowing, that maybe separates people who really engage with fiction and those who don't really get into it very much.
That's really interesting. I haven't thought about that before, but maybe you're right. I mean, we work so hard in our lives. We make so many decisions. There's so much conscious action that we're engaged in. You know, I could very well understand. In fact, in my own life, I love to sort of cede that authority whenever I can and just kick back in front of a television and let my mind sort of fugue out and let someone else do the visualizing for me. I mean, I love that as much as the next person. And maybe it does have something to do with that. I mean, you know, for me, as it happens, I really, when I read, I find it to feel very much like it's not an active participation. It's only when I think back on the reading experience that it seems like I've done this tremendous amount of work that I just try to describe in my book. You know, reading for me, when I think about it, is relaxing because it does feel like I'm just kicking back and being taken along for a ride. And like I said at the beginning, it does feel, when we describe the reading experience, when other people describe it to me and when I describe it to others, it does feel like watching a movie. And yet, you're right. Maybe it is that sort of work that we're unaware that we're doing that, you know, some people might be more aware of it than others and may just not want to be doing it. But I've never really thought about it. It's a very interesting question.
Does the kind of reading you have to do in order to divine what you need to know to design a cover that really works, does that diminish your enjoyment of a novel at all?
It does, actually, in a way, because I can't completely just relax into it. And, you know, a book should feel like you can just lose yourself in it. And, you know, I have to make notes when I'm reading to design covers, and I have to be really hyper aware of kind of what the author's project is when I'm reading. I imagine critics sort of read in a very similar way. I know editors do as well. So whenever something's happening, you sort of have to think to yourself, well, why is this happening? Is this a particularly pregnant moment in the text? does it, you know, is this thing that's happening a stand-in for something else? It's, you know, how structurally important is it? So you sort of read architectonically, and you're reading to parse. So that's not always the most enjoyable way to read. I mean, it has its joys, definitely. It's not sort of the way I read for recreation. Unfortunately, it's a very hard thing to turn off.
Yeah.
Because I do it so often, just looking for these visual prompts that, you know, even when I read just for fun, I find myself, you know, it's a busman's holiday. I sort of find myself inadvertently designing a cover. It's a terrible plague, but yeah, it happens to me almost every time out now. And I'm, you know, I look forward to my retirement at some point in that I can sort of read like a normal person again.
We'll see if it comes back to you.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Lance on the line in Dallas. Hi, Lance.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Yes. When I was in college, I read a book called Ways of Seeing as part of the curriculum by John Berger. I may be pronouncing that name wrong. And it greatly influenced kind of my view of how we see art and news and the media. And I was just kind of curious if your guest had come across that book and could comment on that.
All I will say is that it's one of the more embarrassing things that I will ever say lives that I haven't read it. It's a classic. Everybody I know has read it. I really should have read it. I probably should have read it as preparation to writing this book of my own. But and I've worked with him on on other books of his. I've done jackets for him in the past. And I think as soon as this interview is over, I'm going to go out and buy the book and I'm going to read it. It's humiliating that I have not read it. But yeah, like I said, it's going to be the next stop.
Well, there's only so many hours in the day, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's go back to the phone now. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
So I was wondering about your views on books versus audiobooks. I love audiobooks. I mean, you know, I'm driving around. It's very easy to listen to. And I've gotten to the point where, you know, I even will follow a narrator across different authors because they do such a great job. So I'm just curious your thoughts on audiobooks versus books and how that could change your perception, kind of like when you're talking about movies versus books.
Interesting question.
Yeah, that's
Thanks.
A great question. Yeah. You know, I love audiobooks also, and I listen to them anytime I have a lengthy drive. And yeah, it's great. I would just probably say that the analogy there with films is that, you know, when you see Keira Knightley as Anna Karenina, and she sort of infects the way you picture her, it's the same with voices. I mean, I hear in my mind's ear when I'm reading, like I said, and I would think that if you've listened to, say, a classic, something that you're going to reread, that it might be hard to get that particular narrator's voice out of your head when you're rereading the book. And, you know, they're wonderful things. And like I said, I listen to them all the time. I would just, I would probably exercise the same caution that I use in terms of seeing film adaptations with audiobooks if it's something that I think I'm going to read again. And it could be the world's most wonderful actor performing them. I still really enjoy the purity of not having those real-world prompts when I'm reading a book that I really, really love. So most of the time when I'm listening to an audiobook, it's something that I'm going to enjoy, but I it's probably not a book that I'm going to read again.
So if we agreed that, you know, very often when we're reading, what the author is giving us is really just these kind of visual pencil sketches punctuated by these bits that are completely, you know, fully colored and fully articulated, maybe that means we don't need to see when we read.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm not qualified to say if we even do. I don't know what our mental content is. I actually don't think anybody knows what our mental content is. Is it words? Is it pictures? Is it some form of structural analysis? I don't really know what's going on up there, but I think that, you know, maybe the whole idea of picturing is a myth. It's very possible. And it would take better minds than mine to say that for sure. But the more you sort of introspectively examine what's going on, the more I at least feel like the floor just kind of falls out. And actually, I would say most of what I do when I read, not just because I'm a designer, as I was saying earlier, and I do read structurally, but that significance is what we're reading for, you know? And significance isn't something that you can picture. It's something that you feel.
It is. It does seem that a novel, unlike almost any other form of art, is a more personal experience. You know, everybody can look at a painting and come away with a different idea, but everybody sees the same painting. On the other hand, whatever it is that we experience in a sensory way, even imaginatively, that's different for every human being.
Yeah, it's a great thing, actually. And you know, for every other form of media, for every other art form, there is a direct reception of some kind. With music, you are hearing the notes. You are hearing the vibrations in the air. They directly interact with your ear. When you're seeing a piece of art, you're seeing the colors and shapes. With a book, you're seeing the letter forms. And then somehow that's transmuted into something else. And it's that part of the process that makes it truly special. And it is, in fact, mysterious. And I think that it's because of that that we're sort of that's the inroad, that's sort of the door in for us, that there is something amorphous that's going on, and we can fill things out the way we would like, and it really does make fiction a particular case, and a particularly great case, I think.
Peter Mendelsohn is Associate Art Director of Alfred A. Knopf Books and author of What We See When We Read. Peter, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.